Good afternoon and welcome to The Lunchroom on Radio Caribbean International for Tuesday, the 3rd of June, 2025. This is program number 1384 of The Lunchroom, and I'm your host, Calix George Jr. Now, in addition to 101.1 FM radio, you can also get us at our website. It is rcistlucia.com. You can download our previous shows on that platform. And we are also available on our Facebook page. You just have to search for the official page of Radio Caribbean International. And please be sure to like and share that as well with your friends and family. If you'd like to call in to tell us what's on your plate today, we certainly will welcome that. And the number to call in is 452-3046. Again, 452-3046. And as well, you can call into our WhatsApp number. That is 724-0008. Now, today we want to send out some birthday greetings. First to the island's Speaker of the House of Assembly, and he is Mr. Claudius Francis. It's his very special day today, and wishing him a wonderful, wonderful birthday celebration. We also want to send out birthday greetings to Dr. Vasantha Chase. And we're wishing her a wonderful and blessed birthday and hope that it is a marvelous day indeed. And also to Mr. Thaddeus M. Antoine. He's celebrating his birthday as well and wishing him an absolutely fantastic birthday. Hope it is an enjoyable one. And we also want to send birthday greetings to Mr. Shah Daisy. Happy, happy birthday to you, sir. Hope you're having a very, very blessed birthday as well. Look back in time, and of course we go first into the year 1621, when the Dutch West India Company received a charter for the West Indies, the Americas, Caribbean, and West Africa. In the year 1929, on this day, Chile and Peru signed the Treaty of Lima, finally resolving their border dispute from the War of the Pacific, which occurred between 1879 and 1883, and Chile kept Arica, and Peru regained the province of Tacna. In the year 1943, on this day, a mob of 60 individuals from the Los Angeles Naval Reserve Armory beat up everyone perceived to be Hispanic, starting a week-long riot, set of riots known as the Zoot Suit Riots. In the year 1979, the Ixtoc 1 rig in the Gulf of Mexico blew out, spilling 3 million barrels of oil in one of the worst oil spills in history. And in 1989, on this day, the beginning of the Tiananmen Square massacre as Chinese troops opened fire on pro-democracy supporters in Beijing, China. We now head to our dish of the day. The Daily Dish is brought to you the kind compliments of our good friends at Tiles Plus.
One test for your home, I see. Bathroom, kitchen, pantry. Need test for your balcony. Come down to Tiles Plus, satisfaction guarantee. Tiles Plus, Tiles Plus, Tiles Plus. Big test with unbeatable cost. Customer service, A plus. Did all kind of tests. Come down to Tiles Plus. We also got glass, sway, and vanity. Box, doors, you'll see. Come down, don't mind nobody. We got the best tiles on island. Trust me. We are located Land Street in Castries, Bosses, Hugh Grozzi Lane, and Slack Street in Viewfort. Telephone number 453-7939. Tiles Plus.
Serving now, the Daily Dish.
Welcome back to our program for today. And of course, first we want to pay our respects to the memories of individuals who have most recently gone and transitioned to the great beyond. And unfortunately, yesterday, the news of the passing of Miss Nicole David certainly sent a lot of shockwaves for people across the cultural space in St. Lucia. Her friends and family, of course, were very saddened by what was certainly a relatively a long battle with cancer. And, of course, it is one of those terrible words, which, of course, unfortunately is known all too well among so many different families. In fact, just recently, I remember in a supermarket, I ended up meeting a gentleman who we had interviewed through the Ministry of Health some years ago. And he was, in fact, a cancer survivor. He was able to tell a wonderful story of his own survival of cancer. And there are people who are able to do so, but unfortunately, even so, you do find that sometimes it comes back and with even greater vigor. And so certainly the loss of somebody so vibrant, so energetic, of course, an individual who was a soca performer, who was quite often the life of the party, and in fact, quite often you would see her, you know, singing at karaoke events, which she would be hosting, and keeping people bubbly, keeping people energetic, bringing life and vibe and entertainment to people. And unfortunately, she, of course, has gone on, well, perhaps some may even say she's gone on to a place where she can no longer has to suffer, that she is in fact in a better place. And we certainly want to remember her and all the achievements that she has made, you know, personal achievements in the field of music. It certainly is something that I think will continue to live on, especially at this moment, of course, as we are in the throes of the Calypso season, the carnival season. The local musical content is being ramped up. Everybody's jostling to ensure that their music is being heard. And I hope, of course, and I have no doubt that we will also be hearing some of her music as well. And so Nikki David, as she was very much known and loved by so many, is certainly one of those great performers who has left her indelible mark on the cultural space of St. Lucia, the memories of people. And so you certainly want to pay homage to her and her memory at this time. And of course, to express our condolences to her family, her relatives, and friends. Unfortunately, we also lost another great cultural giant yesterday afternoon as well, and in a different space, not one of music, but one of physical manifestations through that of sculpting. And I speak of Mr. Joseph Udovic. Many would have known his work and would have seen him over the years. And whenever you might have been going on around the island tour or taking a trip down, you know, down towards Soufre or whatnot, it would be very hard for you to miss that very large sign around Goodlands stating Udovic's art studio. And he certainly carved out a space, a very special space, a niche within our tourism product, within our cultural space. And he did so through his hands. He did so through working the materials that exist around us. And in particular, we are in a land that is very green, that is verdant as a result of wood and the trees that grow around us. And he took that especially and did marvelous work through it, and certainly inspired a lot of other individuals to follow in his footsteps and to take up that art form. Of course, it became very much a common stop for individuals, as I said, to make a point of visiting Udovic's art studio, to get a souvenir, to get something about St. Lucia, to get a memory, and to capture it in that tangible form. And so certainly he has been able in many respects to pass on his talent and his skills, and very much so in particular through his son Jalim, who is certainly very well known in his own right in St. Lucia as a result of the many sculptures that he's been able to develop and hopefully will continue to be able to produce in St. Lucia and beyond. Of course, lots of work being done has been done by Jalim in China and other places. And so certainly we want to remember him and what he was able to achieve. Originally from Babono, but certainly an island-wide, a national figure. And his work certainly and his memory through what he has been able to achieve is one that we hope will be able to continue into the as this country continues to grow in terms of its art. And so certainly we want to remember Mr. Joseph Udovic and of course extend our condolences to his children who have and of course his family who have been left behind to mourn and remember him. And so certainly he too will be missed by many here in St. Lucia and beyond. I also want to make mention of Mr. Dunstan DeMille. He, unfortunately, also another individual who has passed recently. And that is, again, a pretty big blow, especially for those within the ag sector, the food sector here in St. Lucia. He was an individual who played a very important role in terms of procurement, of provisions through the supermarkets. And so certainly, too, we want to extend our condolences to his family and also recognize the contribution that he has made in terms of national development. So our condolences, our commiserations to all the families, friends, relatives of the demise at this time. And we do hope that we will be able to remember people as well, even before they move on. I think that is also a very important step as a society. I think we're making some progress in that regard, but certainly there's a lot of other people who certainly do need to be remembered for their contributions as well. Now, I want to touch on a little bit on the matter of land today and the issue of crown lands in particular. There's been a lot of course, conversation about land. Land is so very vital for our existence. And we know that there's less land than there's water, right, in the world. And the land that we do have is usually in pretty short supply. And of course, even when you do have land, it's not all the same in terms of its capabilities, its capacity, what it can or cannot achieve and do. And for example, you look at countries like Egypt, right? And it's a pretty large country, but the vast majority of Egypt is desert and mountainous, barren mountainous regions towards the Red Sea as well. And so very little of Egypt itself can actually bring forth life, if you like. And yet still, the little that exists there along the River Nile, that region that gets flooded by the Nile and then opens up into the Nile River Delta, is effectively that main artery of life for so many people. And so, of course, you see how the population is very, very much concentrated within some of these spaces. And of course, Cairo, one of the largest cities in the world, very, very densely populated as a result of that. And so land is vital for development. In fact, we recognize the factors of production, land, labor, capital, and know-how or technology, right? Skills. And those are very vital. And so, of course, land is one of the starting point for development and for pretty much all our activities are generally happening within that space. And so the 152,000 acres that we have here in St. Lucia, for the most part, is somewhat finite. Albeit, there are opportunities maybe for reclamation, and we've seen some reclamation over the years. You can think, of course, to the Pigeon Island Causeway. You can think to dredging of certain areas in Rodney Bay and trying to allow that land that may have been waterlogged and wet and to become useful in the Bois d'Auge area. We've seen a lot of that happening as well with reclamation of land in some of these areas. And of course, when you look at Castries, it is in fact a product of a fair bit of reclamation as well. Castries effectively was a mud flat which eventually got developed from around the 1760s. And eventually, over time, more and more of the land became was reclaimed from the sea. So even where, where our port is located, where the market is, that whole area of Conway, where you have the botanic gardens and the Darling Road apartments, that was all underwater. Right, it was actually at one point called the New Reclamation Grounds back in the 1890s or thereabouts when it was recently reclaimed. And of course later on the regions around Banans, the Hospital Road area, so areas like Fuasho and Banan are also some of these areas which have been reclaimed. Now in terms of ownership, the most of the land in St. Lucia is owned privately. Right, and that is something that has happened years and years back when we, of course, saw that colonial period. Individuals from French mostly came across from Martinique and elsewhere, and they were given land grants, and the land was invariably subdivided, and regardless of how useful it was or not, it was subdivided and people began owning it. And of course, inevitably, the vast majority of the land was subdivided. And over time, the government, or the crown, if you prefer, was able to actually reclaim some of that land or claw back, reacquire some of that land. And of course, especially in the mountainous regions, a lot of that land was then brought under state control because a lot of it really was never used. It was abandoned, very difficult terrain. And so what you find then is that in the case of St. Lucia, we are pretty limited in the amount of crown land that actually exists. I think less than a quarter of the island is actually owned by the state, by the crown. You can juxtapose that against other places like Trinidad, for example. I think in the case of Trinidad, nearly half of all the land in Trinidad is actually still owned by the state. Very different in the case of St. Lucia. Most of the land is, in fact, owned privately. And in the case, even when the state or the crown owns property, the vast majority of state assets are actually in forest reserve. And when I say assets, I'm talking about land assets. Forest reserve, right? And so it used to be at one point about 19,000 acres. I think they've added a couple more thousand acres, maybe about 23,000 or so acres of St. Lucia fall within the forest reserve, right? And so we have some pretty large parcels of forest reserve, the central forest reserve in the heart of the island, largely in Souffre, parts of Anslery, as well as Miku. You also have the Denry Waterworks Reserve, which is another forest reserve area, pretty small in comparison to that large major tract within the center of the island. And as well, you have the Castries Waterworks Reserve, which is principally La Sorcière, that major mountain in the northeastern part of the island, highest peak within that region. And a few other little smaller reserves exist, like in Marquis, for example. You've got a couple of reserves there. But invariably, most, as I said, most of the land that is actually owned by the Crown is with the, is forested, right? And it actually needs to remain forested because it serves a really important protection for our water resources, and also from the context of flood mitigation. It serves as a sink. It serves as a sponge, so to speak, to prevent the impacts of flooding or terrible flooding even further downstream. And of course, we've seen the impacts over the years of clearance, poor clearance of land that is not suitable for agriculture. And of course, we've had the Ravine-Poisseau disasters in 1938, and we've had other landslides over the years. And so we know that that is because of our soils, it's something that it requires conservation. So in truth, we should probably have even a lot more of those lands protected than are actually protected currently. And that actually has been something that should be an ongoing program of government, to actually try to acquire more of these very vulnerable lands that are not very suited for agriculture, and maybe at best could be utilized for tree crops, but certainly not for clear cutting and tilling and that form of agriculture. Definitely not. And in fact, most of St. Lucia, when you look at the land capability breakdown of St. Lucia, most of St. Lucia is in fact classed within that area. We only have about 5% of the island considered to be arable land. And so that's where we have a lot of challenges, therefore, in terms of how do you then balance your need for food security? How do you balance your need for conservation, right? As well as that growing demand for more and more land for housing, right? A particular housing. I mean, there are a lot of other uses, of course, touristic and institutional uses, but the housing matter is a pretty ticklish one because, of course, times have changed and the human being desires a broader footprint. A lot of people want more space. They want to have their own detached home where they can enjoy their own privacy. And that has tended to be the general desire for a lot of people in terms of the housing style that we have pushed forward. In fact, there was a time when you look at the city of Castries, the historic grid of the city of Castries, would in fact have supported far, far more people than it currently does. At one point, I think Castries had a population upwards of 4,000 people just in that little downtown area. And so, of course, over time, what has happened, people move out, they spread out further up into these hills, up into the suburbs, new areas created. The advent of the vehicle, of course, allowed now for urban sprawl. And so we have, in fact, been seeing a lot of that. But even so, there has been a challenge of housing in and around Castries. And that is, of course, as a result of rural-urban shift, urban migration, which was happening for a very long time. If you look at the data, from as far back as the 1880s, you were seeing already people moving towards Castries for opportunities, for work, whether it was in coal, whether it later on became in terms of construction as a result of the military bases in the Mon and Vigy and the like. And later on, it was because of other the lack of productivity within the agricultural sector led for people to look towards the city, the town, as the go-to place for growth. And so, as a result of that, we ended up with a lot of unplanned development in and around Castries. And it is certainly a matter that is still a major concern and has been a challenge for governments decade after decade to be able to try to keep up with this growing demand for housing. And of course, you've seen some projects over the years trying to catch up effectively, right? And of course, within the government sector, in the public space, you know, projects like very early on, even the George Charles Boulevard was an early project, Le Clery, an early project. Later on, and Sans Souci, and the likes of the Mon and Entrepot. And then later on, places like Caroli, right, and beyond, Grand Riviere, Mornier, looking for opportunities to create housing. And we have not been able to sufficiently deal with that issue of a housing deficit. Because what effectively is happening is that our housing size, our household size, is getting smaller and smaller. So whereas back in maybe the 1960s and 70s, there may have been about four people in the household. Right now, I think it's averaging somewhere around 2.6. And so it therefore means that if your household size is getting smaller, you need more housing. You actually have a lot more one-person households than ever before. I think nearly a quarter of all the households in St. Lucia might very well be one-person households. So, of course, the dynamic is changing in terms of household size and what people may be looking for. And, of course, it is putting pressure on the housing stock. And, of course, at the same time, you have an aging housing stock in some areas which have decayed. They are no longer deemed to be useful. And so it is a problem for a lot of people. And coming back now in terms of the challenge to government, in a lot of instances, they don't actually own the land that would be useful for housing. And so therefore, it means then that in many instances, government has to see how best it can utilize its housing, the available housing that it has or the available land that it has. But it is not so simple. Now, of course, quite recently in the last budget, the Prime Minister did make mention that they are going to be looking at the matter of instances where you have individuals who've been living on Crown lands for an extended period of time, that those persons, that they look at the situation, depending on, of course, I guess, where the land is, and if, in fact, there are no other purposes, then government will then in fact, divest and to provide ownership for to these individuals. Now, of course, remember, this was part of a program called PROUD, which had been going on for a number of years now. And I do want to make a point, because I actually did hear a candidate of the United Workers Party suggesting that, you know, if persons are already living on Crown property over 30 years, then they can claim that Crown property by prescription. That's inaccurate. In the case of Crown property, it cannot be claimed by prescription. That's a major difference between private property under the law and Crown property. You could potentially be squatting or have taken possession of a private property, a private land holding. And if you can, in fact, prove that you've been living there over a 30-year period, then you can go through the process of claiming the property. So it's automatic. You still have to go through a process of trying to claim that property on the basis that you've had occupation of the property for that period of time. But of course, in the case of, as I said, in the case of Crown lands, that does not hold. So even if you may have been living on Crown lands for 100 years, for argument's sake, the Crown still has the right to its property. And it can never be claimed. It could never go away from the Crown. It's a little different, actually, in, and of course, again, one of the rights of the Crown is that where properties have been deemed to be unclaimed, where there's no clear owner for the for a property, that they are considered Crown property. So it goes the other way. It goes to the Crown. And those are known as Crown unclaimed properties. Now, in those instances, if in fact you can show that your family or your ancestors, in fact, did use the land or never claimed it, especially at the time when there was this entire process known as the land titling, land registration and titling project back in the 1980s, which came out of a land commission, land reform commission undertaking, then you could potentially gain that land. But it had to have been unclaimed. So there is a distinction in dealing with Crown unclaimed properties in that sense. But in general, Crown properties cannot be are not impacted by prescription. And so, therefore, the Crown has, therefore, if in fact the Crown wants to provide those lands to individuals, then it has to go through that process of actually, well, providing that or deeding that land to those individuals. So, just what I wanted to clarify. Some of those points, because we are hearing quite a lot about land and Crown lands, and quite a lot is being said, but just wanted to make a few points on the matter of land. That's our dish of the day. When we come back, we're going to take in our weather report.
This has been The Daily Dish.
One test for your home, I see. Bathroom, kitchen, pantry. Need tests for your balcony. Come down to Test Plus, satisfaction guarantee. Test Plus, Test Plus, Test Plus. Big test with unbeatable cost. Customer service, A plus. Need all kind of tests. Come down to Test Plus. We also got glass, sway, and vanity. Boss, boss, you'll see. Come down, don't mind nobody. We got the best tests on island. Trust me. We are located Land Street in Castries, Bosses, you Grozy Lakes, and Clark Street in Viewfort. Telephone number 453-7939.
Island Star, yeah. We got the time to make you go. Oh. We got the time to make you say, yeah. We'll have to make the right choice. Island Style, whoa. We got the time that will make you happy. Island Style, oh yeah. We make your dream come alive in Island Style.
We have tiles and tin sets, pieces and ground. Need this on the house out for the best price and the latest style. Take a little drive down to Island Style Car.
We got the time to make you go. Oh. We got the time to make you say, yeah. Quality, price, service, choice. It's all an Island Style.
Visit us at our showrooms in Belarusa, Rodney Bay, on the John Crompton Highway, Castries, and behind Ruby's Gas Station on the Library Viewfort Highway. Or call us on 450-452 or 453-TILE. Island Style, Tile and Bath. When you think tile, think Island Style.
This is Radio Caribbean International. It's now time for the weather news.
So, of course, on the 1.4, it's now time for your weather report as of 12 noon today, presented by Island Style, Talon Bath. The forecast for St. Lucia Valley for the next 24 hours, the winds will be blowing from between the east, northeast, and east near 20 miles per hour or 31 kilometers per hour. The weather fair skies becoming cloudy at times with a few showers. The forecast for the Los Angeles, fair to partly cloudy with a few brief showers. And the tropical weather outlook, the Atlantic high pressure system will continue to generate moderate eastern winds across the eastern Caribbean region during the next few days. Low-level cloud shifting along the wind flow will cause brief showers over the Los Angeles during the forecast period. Also, a tropical wave located over the eastern tropical Atlantic is moving westward near 10 miles per hour or 17 kilometers per hour. Also, a tropical cyclone formation is not expected over the tropical Atlantic during the next 2 days. And this was your weather forecast as of 12 noon today, presented by Island Style Talamba.
This has been RCI's Weather News. For more information, call the Weather Hotline at 454-3452. RCI 101 number 1.
Island Style. We got the time to make you go. We got the time to make you say, yeah. We'll have to make the right choice.
Spaces and ground. Everything you need is on the house out. For the best price and the latest style, take a little drive down to Island Style Car.
We got the time to make you go. Oh. We got the time to make you say, quality, yeah. Price, service, choice. It's all an Island Style.
Visit us at our showrooms in Belarusa, Rodney Bay, on the John Crompton Highway, Cass Street, and behind Ruby's Gas Station on the Library Viewfort Highway. Or call us on 450-452 or 453-TILE. Island Style, Tile and Bath. When you think tile, think Island Style.
And welcome back to our program here at the Lunchroom on Radio Caribbean International. Of course, you can call in to tell us what's on your plate today, and we're going to head to the phone lines to try to take in some calls right away. I believe we have one coming in, and let's head to the phone lines. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Lunchroom, and what's on your plate today?
Good afternoon, Sir George Jr.
How are you doing, sir?
How is family? Everybody good?
They're good, thank you. Very blessed. No, I have not even read that yet. I was coming to that one.
What's his name again?
Raheem Augustine.
Eh?
Raheem Augustine.
Yeah, Raheem Augustine.
Yes.
Eh?
Sorry?
No, Augustine Joseph.
Oh, he might have a, yes, I'm sure. Let me see if he actually might have a, yes, you might be right about that. Yes. Let me get it.
He's a law student or something.
I think he's completed his law degree. I think he's now doing,
doing research or whatever.
He's doing another program right now
because I was,
as a Rhodes Scholar.
I saw him on UTV last night.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, interviewing. I feel I know his people, you know, Augustine Joseph, like KNT and them.
Ah, okay.
Prominent professor in Howard, law professor and so on.
Okay.
Howard, who is responsible for establishing a sort of foundation, I think it's called Nkrumah Gavi Foundation.
Interesting, okay.
You know, to link the whole diaspora and all African people at home and abroad, wherever. Try and redress, you know, the circumstances we've been facing for how many centuries. You know, and we don't need to rehash over that, you know, because the worst that we have been through, the worst, and slavery, there's nothing as you know.
There's nothing comparable.
Slavery,
right.
What we went through. And over a period of centuries, we have enriched all. That another generation of another black generation doesn't go down into that quagmire which we find ourselves, you know, to a great extent. And these people are, this gentleman has been commissioned with this responsibility of, you know, and this same young man. interviewing him, you know.
Good stuff.
And, nice interview. Half an hour interview, and he was, you know, the objectives. So you outlined the objectives of that foundation, how we need to first understand the reasons for our poverty, which is we have been used as cheap labor, as well as lack of access to our own resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then this is, we need to redress that with, you know, innovation and access to our resources.
Mm.
Which is where the challenge is going to be. So I just wanted to mention that, Mr. George, so that, you know, like I keep saying, that a lot of solutions. Young solution, not so young, but fairly young. Some young ones doing great work, achieving great things.
Yes.
And it's important that what the that program, that UE program, is bringing it, is making it accessible to us, that we could tune on to that.
Yeah, it's very important in terms of public education and awareness, broader awareness.
Because,
yeah.
You know, we have to debunk the whole, you know, perception of elitism in higher education.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And we must find the relevance and make the connect why. So it's very, very important thing, and I think more solutions should make it their duty. So yes, because it's very important to be just for solutions.
Caller, I think you're very faint. Eh? You. I'm not sure that we're hearing you very clearly.
It's faint.
Go ahead. That's better. Yes.
Yeah. Maybe I wasn't talking enough in the thing.
Maybe so, yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, it's very important, I'm saying, that we should tune on and find out what our young academics are doing to improve the standard of living for all of us.
Right.
Not just in the region, but in the whole diaspora.
That is correct. That is correct.
And, this is what ultimately, higher education should mean, you know, enlightenment to your people, you know.
I think there are some efforts. I'm not sure where they are, especially in terms of connecting the diaspora. For example, Dr. Cato Lorenzen, I know he was trying to work on a St. Lucia Academy of Arts and Sciences to sort of try to network various individuals, wherever they might be, whether in North America, Europe, all around the world, who may be doing different scholarship, areas of academic pursuit and research, and to be able to ensure that they can share that sometimes, you know, and ensure that it's actually resounding to the benefit of St. Lucia. You know, we have a situation where a lot of people are making very great contributions outside to the development of other places, but certainly some of it needs to come back. Yeah. So definitely, very important point that you're raising, and we will share that in a little bit. Okay, thanks very much for that, caller.
All right. Yeah.
The other point I just wanted to raise before we leave the matter of land, and it's the matter of ownership. Now, we have a situation sometimes where you have governments coming in place and the MP somehow believes that they have the right to effectively control the state assets and state resources. Now, that can be a very ticklish thing, right? And this is why government doesn't work that way, right? You're supposed to have properties perhaps vested into particular agencies or institutions, and they have responsibilities for the management of those assets within the context of the public good, right? But it should not be a situation where any MP ever feels that they own or they can simply dictate what happens with a particular property or asset. I mean, just recently the Prime Minister was making a point down in Miku, and that was at the passing out parade for 50 new fire officers, and he was speaking to an ongoing project to strengthen the St. Lucia Fire Service, providing them with new fire trucks, fire tenders, and ambulances. And he gave a long list of the number of items that are going to be provided to the St. Lucia Fire Service this year. And he was making the point that, you know, the St. Lucia Fire Service cannot pick and choose whose house they go to respond to if there's a fire, or if there's somebody who has an emergency and you need an ambulance to come to respond. They're not going to look to see who this person might be and whether they like the person or not, or whether the person supports one side or the other. These are public goods. These are services that are for everybody, and they have to be managed in that way. And so we want to be careful too, because sometimes you can, especially at the constituency level, sometimes some MPs might believe that they have full say over state property. Doesn't quite work that way. Just recently there was, we've seen it a couple times. In the first instance, I think quite recently, we know of one former MP who quite often used to have an event up in a Forestier, in a part of his constituency, on the Forestier playing field on none other than Good Friday, a day, in fact, under the laws of St. Lucia, one is prohibited to sell any alcohol. But anyways, there's this usual event that he seems to host up there. And then you saw a situation where heavy machinery was just going in and grading, and without seemingly any permission from any relevant state authority to be able to change and to, I suppose, in his mind, maybe do some kind of improvement on the facility. But that's a very ticklish thing. You've got to be very careful in those things, that once you've got to have the appropriate authorization to, in fact, enact works on state property. Nobody can just go into a school and believe that, even if it's out of goodwill, that this school needs a paint job, so I'm going to take it upon myself to just go and paint the school. Or this building is on state property and it's unsightly, in my opinion, so I'm just going to hire a contractor to go and knock down that building, right? We've seen this happen in the past. Or in the very recently, a situation where apparently a group decides where, they're having a political meeting at a particular court in that very same constituency of Castries Southeast, and decides, we will just paint that court yellow. I mean, so we've got to be a little bit mindful about state assets and state resources, and to still appreciate that at the end of the day, they do have, the owner is in fact the crown, the state, and that there are procedures through which, in the first instance, these things may be placed under management control of particular agencies, and so even when that happens, sometimes there may very well be terms and conditions for those agencies and oversight of those agencies to ensure that they conform with whatever is an appropriate maintenance regime and management for those agencies, to ensure that there is openness, if it's available for everybody, and it is being used for the intended purpose. So the matter of state resources is a very important one, and management of state resources. Unfortunately, I suspect that the Commissioner of Crown Lands office is not is perhaps one of those agencies that is not properly provided with the kind of human resource capacity and other capacities to be able to handle this task, which is a very extensive one. When you look, for example, in the case of the United Kingdom, they have what is known as the Crown Estate, and it is in fact a sort of statutory agency. It is managed very carefully, and it actually is very profitable, as one could well imagine. And a lot of the profitability that it has comes from the fact that the state has control over the seabed. And so all activities such as, mining, as well as, you know, oil for oil and gas, as well as things like renewable energy, offshore wind farms, they all have to get approvals. They all have to be provided with the necessary approvals and leases of those properties. And of course, that brings in a fair amount of money with respect to the use of those areas. So we certainly do have to look at the matter of state assets and how those assets are managed and maintained, because it is everybody, it's for the benefit of everybody, the common good. And so if we have to ensure that there is sustainable use, it has to be thought out and properly managed. One of the areas, of course, where we're seeing some of these conflicts as we're speaking about the blue economy, we're speaking about the use of the sea. As of now, if you have to go out to fish, I think you do need a fishing license, but and there are some safeguards regarding that. But where you're seeing some of the conflicts now is the matter of what is a very quickly growing activity, and that is the sea moss cultivation and harvesting, which of course happens out in the water. And the way it's set up is that people go out, they effectively put down their stakes or in some portion of water, and they lay claim, right? And really and truly, they're laying claim to Crown property. And they, of course, it has to be managed in such a way, because you can have conflicts with other users, whether those users may be trying to have leisure time, they may be wanting to enjoy the beach, they may be wanting to enjoy leisure pursuits like snorkeling or whatever. You may find that there are fishers as well who want to engage in fishing in certain areas, and you have potential conflicts. And so in all of these areas, the management function is very important in dealing with Crown assets, and in particular, the role of the Crown Lands office in this regard perhaps needs to be looked at and strengthened, so as to ensure that they can in fact achieve their responsibilities. Now, I did say that we were trying to get into that article. I suspect I would not be doing it justice again if we actually took it up right about now, because we're actually 1 minute away from the hour of 2 o'clock. So I won't get into that article today. Perhaps we can take it up tomorrow after we do our Republic Corner. We will look at just that. One of the things I did want to mention as well, and again, we won't get into it in too much detail, is the matter of this idea that is being put out there regarding visa applications, U.S. visa applications, and that there was some crisis in respect of U.S. visa applications because of St. Lucia's, because of St. Lucia, some issue with the CIP, right? And that's what we were being told, right? Now, I made the point that visa application refusal rates have very little to do with this matter, right? It could be, there are a lot of different factors. You know, it could be the number of people who are going to apply in any 1 year. It could be, you know, the standing of those individuals, depending on whether or not they meet the requisite requirements, the requirements of the U.S. Embassy in that regard. And as well, I mean, there is, of course, some level of profiling that is done by the authorities, by U.S. authorities, when they're looking at individuals, right? Whether these individuals may be flight risks, whether they may potentially remain in the United States, they won't come back. So they look at a lot of different issues. And the truth is, of course, these rates vary from year to year. And that is, that's the norm, right? In fact, as far back as 2006, St. Lucia's rate, at a refusal rate, was in the region of 30.5%. And in fact, at that time, we were higher than, not very much different, but by St. Vincent and the Grenadines then was 25.5%, right? And Grenada was 27.4%. This is 2006, right? Barbados, of course, very low, has traditionally been very low. It was 6.3% in that year. Antigua and Barbuda, Trinidad and Tobago around 19%. Guyana, refusal rate was as high as 60% in 2006. And in Jamaica, in the case of Jamaica, it was 35.9%. In other words, in the case of Guyana, three out of every five individuals who went for a visa would not get it, right? In the case of St. Lucia, three out of 10 would not get it. So you look at those things, but really and truly in 2024, when you look at the rates, St. Lucia is 26.8%. St. Vincent and the Grenadines, 26.6%. So it's, here you have a situation where you have a St. Lucia, right, and a St. Vincent. We're neighboring islands. We're both very similar within the OECS. And the difference here is that St. Lucia has a CIP and St. Vincent has no CIP. And yet still they have pretty much the exact same visa refusal rate. Right. In fact, in the case of Grenada, it's the highest, 33%. Barbados, as I says, it was relatively low. It's 10%. You know, in the case of Antigua and Barbuda, 26.7, very similar to St. Lucia and St. Vincent. Jamaica is 43%. Guyana has actually come down somewhat. It's now 34%, still pretty high in comparison to other Caribbean countries, perhaps. But we know the situation there, of course. Maybe the economy is doing a lot better with oil and gas. But yet still, it's still pretty high. It's higher than St. Lucia, even so. So the matter of visa poverty, as one former MP was suggesting, I'm not sure whether that holds out in terms of the actual figures when you look at the visa refusal rates. And this is, of course, available online at the U.S. State Department. It's publicly available for everybody to see. Thanks to the U.S. government on that one. And I don't know exactly what he might have been referring to when he spoke of this whole matter of CIP and visa poverty. That's our program for today. And we do hope that you'll be able to join us again tomorrow for another one of the Lunchroom here at Radio Caribbean International. Have a good day.